to us, and it's what these great historical literary figures have always advised us to question, whether it's Orwell, whether it's the Gulag Archipelago, whether it's Solzhenitsyn, whether it's, and we have that experience because of the Soviet Union, right? We understand Darkness at Noon, right? These books, Catch-22, Joseph Heller, about the absurdity of rules and bureaucracy that don't make sense. The entire point of these books is to teach us, do not just succumb to whatever the bureaucracy is telling you, but ask questions where things don't make sense. And when people are trying to shut those debates down, that says more to me about what's going on than anything else.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. My show is here alternating Fridays from 6 to 7 p.m. You're listening to a special two-hour excerpt of Majid Nawaz talking to Joe Rogan, recorded on February 17th. Now back to the show.
Isn't it universal, though, in terms of, like, world government? There's not world government that I'm aware of that's very open about what's going on, about failures and mistakes and not understanding the information correctly because they were under an assumption that proved to be incorrect. It's essentially across the board. And isn't part of that just managing some sort of large-scale pandemic with a large population of people and trying to make sense of it all?
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how do you manage that? And you have to have two different things going on. You have to have actual solutions like medication, and you also have to have optics. You have to give the people the impression that you're managing this and you're working very hard to figure this out, and you've come to some uncomfortable conclusions and you made some decisions that maybe are going to upset people, but they're going to help everyone overall.
So we need to go to the origins of COVID to see, again, on a global level then, were they acting in good faith? Right? Now, all the evidence currently indicates no.
And when you say they, who do you mean by they?
People in power.
All the people in power are acting in bad faith?
The people in power that are interacting in our reality. Yeah?
I mean, when we're talking about like leaks and emails that have been exposed, mm-hmm. when you talk about conversations between people that worked in the Wuhan lab, and those are being exposed to us very recently.
Yeah.
I'm under no impression that politicians were aware of these emails before us.
So the lab leak, let's talk through that example, yeah? So one thing we can say, I think quite fairly, is I doubt Fauci's acting in the best possible way he should be acting, right? So he knew about this lab leak thing from the very beginning, and the leaks that have now come out, even the DARPA leaks themselves, indicate that they attempted to suffocate this story. In the UK, we have a similar example, Lancet, which is a very well-respected medical journal. One of the guys that, well, actually the guy that Fauci's federal funding supported, his name is Peter Daszak, EcoHealth Alliance. He's a Brit.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones engaged in gain-of-function research in Wuhan in that lab. Now, there was a letter very early on, and I was, from the beginning, I was questioning the lab leak thing, and again, getting into trouble for doing so. But this is before any of the leaks. But there was still evidence to indicate something wasn't right here.
Brett Weinstein talked about
That's right, on my podcast, very early on. Yeah, absolutely.
But he's an evolutionary biologist. He understood the actual...
And that's why I got him on
itself.
My show as well. There's a video of him on my show talking about this, right? Now, what happened is that this guy that Fauci was funding, Peter Daszak and the EcoHealth Alliance, that's not in dispute that they received federal funding. Fauci in Congress testified and said it wasn't gain of function to Senator Rumpel's sort of hearings. And the leaks have subsequently indicated that they did know that this funding was being used in the lab in Wuhan to make this virus sticky, to make it stronger, and to make it, you know, work for humans, to actually infect humans. Now, Peter Daszak, again, very early on, co-authored a letter in The Lancet, which is a very respected medical journal in the UK, in which, before these leaks came out, they declared that anybody who questions whether this was leaked from a lab is a conspiracy theorist. And it was signed by a number of doctors, and it was among them Peter Daszak. Peter Daszak's the guy that got the funding to do this work. At the bottom of all medical journal articles, you have to declare an interest. Are there any conflicts? And they said, we have no conflicts of interest. So here you've got that these guys wrote a hit piece calling anybody like Brett who questions whether it's a lab leak a conspiracy theorist, while obviously it's him, Peter Daszak, receiving funding to do that very work, writing a piece in a medical journal, smearing those who are attempting to uncover whether he'd received funding to do that very work. I think I'm qualified enough in the human, in human nature, at least, to be able to say he wasn't acting in our best interest.
That's a conflict.
That's a conflict. And that, you see, from the very beginning of this thing, it happened with everything we were saying. Lab leak, masks, lockdowns, mandates. Eventually, the truth came out, but it had to be fought for. So that tells me that the people that were attempting to suffocate this truth, at least, not everybody, but the people that were involved in suffocating the truth and smearing dissidents while knowing, because the leaks indicate that they knew, right? They weren't acting in our best interests. And I think that's a fair conclusion to reach. What were they doing? They were attempting to use this emergency to usher in a new way of doing things. Vaccine passports, even though in the UK and England at least now we've dropped them, and Ireland followed suit, the Czech Republic has followed suit. But it wasn't ever about you not being able to come into, say, into this studio and infect me, because even after they learned that you could still infect me, the vaccine passports were still in place. But they've told us, they meaning people in power, have told us what they want to do next. So the UK is currently the head of the G7 group. That's the world's most economically advanced countries. And the UK currently chairs the G7 group. Our chancellor, who does our economy, called Chancellor of the Exchequer, his name's Rishi Sunak. He's put out this video. This is all on my feeds, by the way, my social feeds. He put out this video saying that what they want to do is bring in this thing called the central banking digital currency. They want to replace fiat paper money with digital money as a competitor to Bitcoin and crypto money, right? But instead of being decentralized currency, it will be controlled by a government. It's digital currency, but controlled centrally through the banks, Bank of England. So instead of having a bank account with whatever, HSBC or Bank of America, you'll have a bank account directly with, in the American context, with the Fed. In the UK, directly with the Bank of England. You have a personal bank account, and you're given digital money in that bank account. These are called central banking digital currencies. The Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK has already announced their intention to do this as the G7 group. And these, if you look up...
This sounds terrifying.
If you look up the Telegraph newspaper...
I've already Googled it, and there's a lot of headlines about it.
Yep, there's a specific article in the Telegraph, Programmable Digital Currency. Yeah. If you can't find it, I'll pull it out from my Twitter feed, and we can talk through it on my feed. But while he's looking for that, I'll talk you through it. So one of these...
Central bank digital currency, is that the one down below?
Digital currency should be programmable. See that one there? Yeah. He's looking at it even on the search. It says the word programmable, the top search result. Yep, so, third line down.
I see.
Yep, should be programmable. Yep.
Mm.
Programming, yeah? Now, see, again, there's a paywall, but maybe...
Start your free trial.
Yeah, but you can see the word there, right? Programming in the headline. Now, what they're doing is they're saying that this digital currency, once you're... Because, you know, everyone knows that with inflation at over 5%, it's now 5.4%, right? Our fiat money, the paper money, is increasingly becoming worthless, and we're headed towards a big disaster. The Fed wants to raise interest rates. But we're in so much debt that if you raise interest rates... people are going to suffer because everyone that you know we're living on debt as Western economies. So they realize that this kind of the lifespan of paper money is fast coming to an end because of the 2008 economic crash in particular. So they're bringing in these central banking digital currencies. Why is that word programmable in there? So what they said in that article, and the Chancellor put a video out saying this as well, they said, right, think back to what vaccine passports were, yeah? If you don't have your jab, you can't even eat in this restaurant. What they've said and why the word programmable was in that headline was they've said that this money that you will earn from work, instead of having paper money, you have this digital money. It's programmable so that you can't buy certain foods, or if you do something that your employer doesn't like, it's all in that article. You won't be able to spend your money. In other words, it's not money. They're vouchers. They're like food vouchers. And they can be programmed so that, like the Chinese social credit system, that if you try and use them on a certain thing, it won't work. You say you want to buy a burger and they want you to buy bugs, which is one of the examples used. If you start to try and buy unhealthy meat, just won't work. You tap your card, you can't buy the thing because you've met your quota that month of burgers. You have to buy something like a vegan meal.
So it won't just be money in the sense of the way we have dollars or pounds today.
Yeah.
It'll be something that's controlled in terms of your ability to distribute it.
Which is why I'm calling it a voucher. It's a coupon.
But even a coupon, if you have a coupon to buy bread, you can still buy the bread. Yeah. Like, there's
but
no...
you can't buy... See, that coupon to buy bread, what you can't do is buy a burger with that coupon. It's for bread.
Right,
yeah?
Right.
So you will have the central banking digital currency. And then what they're talking about in that article that we just pulled up is they'll say, right, and it explicitly uses the words, won't be used on something that the employer deems inappropriate or the state deems inappropriate.
Oh, we got to see this. Yeah? See if we can find that or...
I was digging through a different article about it too. It's talking about there's pilot programs going to be used in the Olympics coming up in China.
Yep.
They've already started it and...
Right now,
do you feel like you're sounding the alarm
for
people that don't understand what the is going on?
So here, I'll put it up for you here, yeah? So there's the video.
Yes.
I don't know if your camera can see that, but
no.
There's the video. There's him speaking about it.
The G7 is launching a set of public policy principles for retail central bank digital currencies, CBDCs. Central bank digital currencies could be a digital version of money, a bit like a digital banknote that could be used alongside...
Right, so that's the guy who runs our economy in the UK. His name's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And here is the article. Bank of England tells ministers to intervene on digital currency programming. Yeah, and here's a quote from the article. This is in the Telegraph, the one he pulled up, but it was behind a paywall, so I'll just read the quote. Digital cash could be programmed to ensure it is only spent on essentials. or goods which an employer or government deems to be sensible.
Oh,
I'm going to take it one step further for you, Joe, right? So the vaccine passport infrastructure is in place. But now we know that the vaccine doesn't stop infection or transmission, but the checkpoint Charlie exists everywhere. They bring in digital banking, central banking digital currencies. You've got a scenario now that you're checking in and out everywhere you go using vouchers that are programmed and you can only spend where you're told you can spend them. There's another word for that, man. That's called the Chinese social credit system. That's what it's called. And anyone who watches Black Mirror will know what I'm talking about. That's that TV show, right?
Yeah.
So what they are telling us, and when I say they, who's they? People in power. That's the head of our economy, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, second most powerful person other than the Prime Minister and maybe the Foreign Secretary in the UK, right? He's telling us, I just played it there for you. He's telling us that's what he, as the UK, the head of the G7, want to bring in for the G7. So a scenario where, like in New York at the moment, because the passport infrastructure is in place, you bring in that digital currency and you've got this total control. And if I'm speaking to you the way I'm speaking now, and my employer or government, you heard that in the quote directly, yeah, deems me as saying or doing something inappropriate, suddenly I can't actually pay to come here and speak to you anymore. My digital currency won't even pay for the ticket because it will be known that I'm coming to speak to you. Sorry, your vouchers don't allow you to purchase that ticket to go and speak to Joe.
And this is where we get into the kind of censorship that we see in social media that is not, it's not, you can't have that kind of censorship with the First Amendment in normal discourse. Mm. But you can have that kind of censorship if you've developed a digital platform that distributes information, but it's a private company.
Yeah.
So think about what money is, where you can spend it on whatever you want, versus this digital currency, which is essentially controlled in a sense,
yeah,
like you have free speech on Twitter, but you really don't.
Because
if you go too far or you talk about something that they don't find appropriate, they'll just ban your account. That could be what we're looking at in terms of what we think of as free speech being social media platforms, could be what we think of as your free range ability to buy whatever you want with whatever money that you've earned.
So what's going on here, right? We're in a moment in history, and this is why I said to you what I can speak to you about with a bit more authority than even the science debate. And I've done my homework on the science debate. I had to, because I had a live show and I was interrogated by the public for 3 hours on a call-in show. I had to have done my homework. And the way you've seen me be able to pull out my receipts, yeah?
Yes.
That's what I had to do on the show. But put the science aside. Where I will speak with a level of authority is political theory, right? I'm a postgraduate in that, and I spent my entire life involved in political structures and political activism and thinking about social contracts. Now, what's going on here is, with this central banking digital currency, if you get to that situation where you end up with the Chinese social credit system in the West, why? Why would anyone want to do that, right? I believe we're in a moment of the Gutenberg press. Go back to when the printing press was invented. Technology disrupts power structures. It always has. Printing and its invention was a new technology. What happened when they invented the printing press? The power structures, who up until that point were reading the Bible for you and were telling you that you got to pay this priest X amount of favors and he'll forgive you your sins. And that became a bribery system, right? Which is what Martin Luther was so upset about when he pinned his thesis to the wall. The printing press disrupted that power dynamic because people could read the Bible for themselves. And they began realizing that the power structures were manipulating what was written to control people. Now, nobody in hindsight is going to argue that printing and its invention is a bad thing for humanity. But at the time, it led to war. It led to the 30 Years' War in Europe. Because it disrupted power so much that people began rising up, and it led to this 30-year period of war, which eventually led to the Reformation, and the rest is history, right? What's today's Gutenberg press? The internet. The decentralization of information, and then because of that, the internet, the decentralization of currency in the form of crypto is disrupting power. Because the way that after the revolution of the Reformation, the printing press, control was still possible, though obviously not to that level, which is why we no longer have those absolute monarchies. But control in a nation state context was still possible to an extent because the money supply was controlled. Now, what's happening is that the invention of the internet with the decentralization of information and in particular here, the decentralization of currency in the form of cryptocurrencies is disrupting those power hierarchies, and it's leading to this conflict now. And we're in a moment. When the printing press was invented, the powers that be needed to try and hold on to that power as the 30 Years' War kicked off. They eventually lost it. But to hold on to it, they became very brutal because they were losing their grip on power. Today, this is what I believe we're witnessing. It's not about vaccine passports. This was a red herring. To have the infrastructure in place that you can have a checkpoint Charlie society, so that when the central banking digital currencies are in place, that infrastructure is already there because people were so scared they voluntarily allowed you to put that in place, so that you can maintain your grip on power, because what's coming around the corner is the decentralization of everything, of media, therefore of narrative. And of course, remember, whoever defines the truth gets to define reality. Decentralization of narratives, decentralization of the economy through crypto. You no longer have the power to define the story and control the money supply. So the powers that be, who are losing that power, need to clamp down. They're clamping down on their own children, because we are people who are born of the West. So it's an internal civil war in a hybrid war context over truth and over information. Centralization versus decentralization, basically. It's no longer about left or right. It's about up versus down. It's about power versus those who don't have power.
Do you think if there was no cryptocurrency, if there was no Bitcoin or any of the other crypto coins, that they would attempt to do some sort of digital currency? Do you think that this is a response to the understanding that that decentralized digital currency is eventually going to take over, or has gained far more momentum than they ever anticipated?
I think so. And also decentralized media, because you can't control the narrative.
Right.
See how easy it was to convince everybody initially that the Iraq war was needed, right? Now, you've got a point today where they haven't been able to convince people of their measures that they wanted to bring in when COVID struck, because it was quicker to be able to unpick that narrative due to decentralization. Shows like this that weren't under the traditional yoke of traditional media were able to have certain conversations. Now, that means that it's harder to control the narrative. And so in a situation like that, when you're losing your grip and power, the only option you have left is to clamp down. And I'm so sorry to say, but that means, like the 30 years war in Europe after the printing press was invented, we may be in for a bit of a rough ride ahead. But we are literally facing a crossroads. Do we go down the direction of centralization or decentralization? It's obvious where I stand. I think ultimately, like happened eventually after the wars of 30 years war, and eventually people need to be respected and they will win. They will win this and we'll end up with a better future. But there's going to be some short-term pain.
And what do you mean by that?
There'll be another emergency, whether it's war with Russia, which is already being played up, whatever it is, whether it's the crash of the economy because of the fiat and the inflation at 5.4%, at least in the UK, it's 5.4% here. I know it's out of control here as well. If the currency collapses, because we're living on printed money at the moment, it's called quantitative easing. We are literally printing ourselves money to try and pay for our debt. We're just printing more money. That's unsustainable. So we're in this situation where any other crisis could occur. If the gas, Putin controls Europe's gas supply. If there's a war with Ukraine, he cuts off the gas supply. There's a Nord Stream 2 pipeline that services Germany, but also other European countries are dependent on Russian gas. So if he shuts off the gas supply, you end up with food shortages. Now, you can go one of two ways. If there's riots because people are hungry, that's a perfect pretext to bring in more draconian power to control society. And people will want it because nobody wants to live in, like, with riots. I mean, people moving away from the West Coast and San Francisco in particular because of some of the crime problems there, right? So people move away from that. But if you've got food shortages everywhere and people end up rioting, it's a good reason to say, right, we need more power to control this. We need more emergency powers. We need stronger laws. And so you end up in a situation where crises can be manipulated to bring in stronger and stronger authority, when really what's going on is we're in this crossroads in history. Now, we will get out of this because ultimately it's a numbers game. And ultimately, in times like this, you end up fighting against your own sons, right? It's those in power fighting their own people. And eventually, the people, are, by sheer numbers, you know, end up becoming the people in power, right? So in the long run, we may well end up in a decentralized world, which will be much better. But as I say, that to get there, we have to get through this period of those in power attempting to hold on to that power.
Do you think it's possible that we won't get there and that we'll wind up in...
Yeah.
A more draconian centralized world?
Everything's possible. Professor John Gray at the LSE questions the idea that history moves in a positive trajectory. He questions the idea that we're only ever going to get better. His theory is in the context of liberalism. We must never take anything for granted, but it's why I've been so vocal. Because everything we've just spoken about, I've looked at this, I've had to reason myself out of totalitarian systems. And so when I see that what I joined, kind of our values that we believe and hold dear to, our civil liberties, what I sacrifice things to defend, if the thing I'm defending is moving in that direction as well, I can see that pattern. I can see the early warning signs. Hannah Arendt is a German Jewish philosopher, was. She wrote about the rise of totalitarianism in Germany to try and understand it. In fact, was one of the leading and first philosophers to try and dissect totalitarianism and how it emerged. And she coined this theory, which is everybody can look it up. It's called the banality of evil. And her basic point was, she ended up living her final years in Israel, and she was really interested in understanding how ordinary, everyday, nice people became Nazis. Yeah? And the banality of evil is her theory that explains it. And the point was that actually good people can do evil things. And they don't even realize they're doing them. And it's incremental. It's step by step. And each incremental step is justified for the common good. Until the like a proverbial frog being boiled alive in water, and because it's a frog and its skin temperature changes with the water, it doesn't realize it's being boiled alive until it's too late and it dies with the boiling water. It doesn't jump out.
Mm.
So that take that proverb, that story, and apply it to Hannah Arendt's theory of the banality of evil. That if you incrementally change, step by step, you change society, before you even realize it, you've got to a point that it's past the point of no return. If that happens, it's very difficult to get out of that without external intervention.
Well, you see this mindset that's very disturbing in online and social media. You see this mindset from people that if you had talked to them 4 or 5 years ago, they would never advocate denying anyone medical help for diseases, for something that they had caused, like say obesity, something that was a personal choice they had made, or an addiction that they had to food or what have you, drug addictions. No one would ever deny medical treatment to those people. You would never advocate for that, especially not publicly and openly. And then an entire group, especially now that we know what you said about how the vaccine at a certain point in time no longer stops transmission, no longer stops infection. Like, you're still giving it to people and you're still getting it. Yeah. So if that is the case, and we know that to be the case now, how can anybody in their right mind, under good conscience, advocate that someone would be denied medical care because they didn't subscribe to the same thing you subscribed to, because they didn't take this inoculation that you took?
Right. So we know that in Israel, when you look at rates, so in terms of percentages now, not just raw figures, but percentages, the rate of COVID is higher among the boosted than it is among...
But don't they have a much higher rate of boosted people?
So that's why I'm saying it's a comparative figure.
Yeah? Okay.
It's adjusted for percentages.
Okay, so even adjusted for percentages. But they have a very low percentage of people that are unvaccinated, right?
So you can sample that with control.
Is it like less than 10%?
It's low. It is low, but there are still some in Israel. But also in the UK, these studies have been done looking at percentages and rates. Prior to Omicron even, in the UK, they found that the rate... This is, in fact, in the Spectator magazine. You can pull it up. The rate of COVID is higher among the vaccinated than the unvaccinated. Rate, not numbers.
Yeah? So what do they attribute that to?
So I don't want to get into the science, because you can speak to people like Robert Malone, as you've done, and they can get into the science here. The questions as to whether, for example, one thing we do know is our health secretary has admitted that it is not normal to roll out mass vaccination during a pandemic, because what that is said to encourage is mutated versions that can evade the vaccine, right? And there's a video of our health secretary even admitting that now. We were saying that a long time ago. They're all admitting this stuff now. And there's something called ADE, which is antibody-dependent enhancement, that the virus could indeed, through evolutionary processes, learn what to evade while it's still in its early stages of its first wave and its second wave, which is why what normally used to happen is you wait for the three waves of a typical pandemic before you start inoculating against that pandemic. But to try and inoculate in the middle of a virus, some scientists are saying, only encourages antibody-dependent enhancement. In other words, a mutated version that specifically targets the vaccinated because it's evolved to evade that spike protein. But take that science away, right? And just let's discuss it from the idea that mass vaccination in the middle of a pandemic, right? You get to a point now where it's openly accepted in media narratives now that this vaccine doesn't stop infection or transmission. And there are articles explicitly saying that the rate of those vaccinated is higher than those who are unvaccinated, but they're still insisting on the vaccine passport. And they're still insisting on demonizing the unvaccinated. Now take Canada. A father was denied access to his child by a judge, reported by the BBC, denied access, visiting rights to his child by a judge because he was unvaccinated on the request of the mother. What purpose does demonizing the unvaccinated serve if the science is no longer supporting their arguments? Yeah. What purpose does it serve to say you can't have an organ transplant if you're not vaccinated? We'll deny you service in a hospital, or we'll lock down only the unvaccinated. Now we know what we know. What purpose do these draconian measures serve? The only thing that makes sense to my mind is what we were talking about, because they are very keen to make sure the infrastructure is there for the central banking digital currencies. For that, you need a checkpoint society to live in that digital world like China.
So meaning they need people to follow every step of what they're mandating, what the law is, what they're advocating for, with no dissent.
The unvaccinated are living proof that vaccine passports are illogical. So you have to demonize that living proof because you need the checkpoint in place, the vaccine passport, not for stopping the virus.
But I don't think that the people that are advocating for this are in favor of or even aware of a digital currency system.
Well, no, they're not.
They're not.
Not the everyday person, no. But that's what demonization, you see, it serves to shut down rational
debate. Right, but here's my question. Yeah. Is this a conspiracy or is this a natural artifact of human behavior?
Neither.
Neither.
It's a revolution.
How so?
In the wrong direction. And there needs to be a counter-revolution.
How is it a revolution?
This is a power grab.
How is it a power grab if the people that are involved, like say the health experts, the people that are doctors and medical experts that are advocating for people to be vaccinated and boosted and for people to, many who even are encouraging mandates for employees.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that have no dog in the fight when it comes to a central digital currency.
Yeah.
They don't even know about this.
Yeah.
So what makes them want all these things in your eyes?
Psychological operation, military grade.
By who?
I'll read it for you.
Okay. Is this the one from Canada?
No, this is now a UK example.
Okay.
So we have a unit called SAGE, which is a scientific advisory group. There was that's the committee that was advising government on pandemic policy. Yeah, it's called SAGE. One of the most prominent members on that was Professor Susan Michie. Yeah. Professor Susan Michie, for 40 years, has been a member of the Communist Party. First point. And she's one of the most prominent members on the scientific advisory group in the UK that formulated, that's the formal committee that formulated our pandemic response. This is from the Daily Mail on the 10th of June, 2021, in an article by James Gant, headlined, "Social distancing and face masks should stay forever," says Communist SAGE committee member Professor Susan Michie. Now, keep that point in mind.
Social distancing and face masks should stay forever.
Yeah. Keep that point in mind, and I'm going to make another point.
Is that a real quote?
Yeah.
That's not clickbait?
That's directly from her. It gets worse, Joe, right? Here's an article.
Here it is. Forever, in all caps, says Communist SAGE committee member Professor Susan Michie. She said, "We never used to pick up dog poo in the park, but learned to over time."
Now, let's move to the next. Because I'm going to build this case up for you. Because I know I said something, military grade psychological operation.
Yes.
I promise you, I'll establish that statement step by step like this by showing you headlines every step of the way. Yeah.
Okay.
The Telegraph reported on 14th of May, 2021, in an article headlined, "Use of fear to control behavior in COVID crisis was totalitarian, admit scientists." These are people that left that group SAGE and they came out and spoke like whistleblowers. And they said, "We were using fear as government policy to psychologically manipulate the public," right? We call it PSYOPs, psychological operations, to try and elicit that fear response. So in answer to your question as to why were people towing the line, they weren't involved in the power grab. It's because they were victims and targets of state-sponsored psychological operations from the scientific committees that should have been looking after us. Now, that article in the Telegraph, I said to you, it's there for you. Everyone says that's a national newspaper in the UK. It's not even a fringe. It's a national broadsheet printed newspaper. The Prime Minister used to write for that newspaper. Yeah, the Telegraph. And as I say, that was the headline. "Use of fear to control behavior in COVID crisis was totalitarian, admit scientists. Members of the scientific pandemic influenza group on behavior express regret about unethical methods." Yeah.
Now, but didn't they use that? But they used that fear to try to get people to comply with what they thought was a good thing, the vaccination.
Well,
they're realizing now, after the dust has settled, that they have regret. They express regret about unethical methods, but they're publicly expressing this regret because they've come to this recognition. So that doesn't seem like a conspiracy to me more than it feels like people under pressure.
So this is not me saying it's a conspiracy. This is me saying, why did every ordinary, everyday people comply? Because of the fear that was deliberately stoked. Yeah?
Yes.
Now, we're going to carry on. So we've got a headline here on the 13th of January, 2022. This is this month, yeah? Again, in the Daily Mail, "Ministers have used propagandistic tactics to scare public into complying with COVID rules," founder of Number 10's Nudge Unit claims. Now, the Nudge Unit is a colloquial term for the behavioral psychology unit in government. It's called SPY B, the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Behavior Group, right? The founder of that unit has come out now and has said he regrets, and he's written a column for a different platform called Unheard, and this is the news piece on his column. So he's written a whole column expressing this regret, and he says he expressed regrets that they used these manipulative methods to encourage fear. But it gets better. Why do they use the word military grade? Yeah. So this so far establishes that, because intent's not relevant for me at this point, right? What I'm describing to you is what happened. Why right. were people scared?
Okay.
Yeah. You know, you could be well-intentioned in doing this, but the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yes.
Right? My okay. point isn't about intentions or conspiracy. This is just what happened. And people need to know that they were manipulated, whether for good or bad intention, that they were manipulated in a way that the people that did it are now expressing regret because they know that this is coming out. So they're trying to get ahead of the curve and admit that they did it. Now, here's another interesting one, right? So there's an MP in the parliament, in the British parliament. His name's Tobias Elwood. He's a Conservative MP. Now, on his own Twitter page, he announces, I'll just read it for you. No point Googling this. I'll just read it for you. On his own, he's got a Twitter page. He announces, delighted to be promoted to Lieutenant Colonel as a reservist in the 77 Brigade. An honor to continue serving Her Majesty's Armed Forces, the most professional in the world, right? What's the 77 Brigade? Well, you go to their website and they tell you what they are. Groups within 77 Brigade. And I'll just read a bit here for you. This is on their own website, yeah? Digital Operations Group provide a specialist capability to deliver influence, activity, and products across a broad range of communications channels. Web Ops Team. The Web Ops Team collects information and understands audience sentiment in the virtual domain, right? With the extent OSINT, that's open source intelligence, policy framework, they may engage with audiences in order to influence perceptions to support operational outcomes. Now, the question is here, you've got a British MP is involved in a military psyops unit called the 77th. Now I'm going to tell you something about Twitter, because we mentioned Twitter, yeah? This is an article in the Middle East Eye. I'll read a direct quote for you. The date is, as it pulls up open here, 30th of September 2019, Middle East Eye. The article's by Ian Cobain. And it's headlined, Twitter executive for Middle East is British Army PsyOps soldier. Part-time officer has worked on behavioral change projects in the region. Gordon McMillan, who joined Twitter, the social media company's UK office 6 years ago, has for several years also served with the 77th Brigade, a unit formed in 2015 to develop non-lethal ways of waging war. Now, I've just read for you, the 77th is engaged in information operations.
Look at this.
And a Twitter executive is a member of the 77th.
A PSYOP soldier.
And this is why I said to you, military-grade psychological operations, not just any psychological operations. This is why people have become so scared. They are victims of PSYOPs. Intentions might be good. Don't you think you, I, Jamie, your listeners had the right to know this was happening to us, regardless of the intention?
Yes. Well, this was listed in an article in September of 2019, right? I mean, we did know about it. At least it was published.
It was exposed in September of 2019. It's a leak. Right. It's an exposer.
Oh, I see.
Not the government saying this is what we're doing to you.
How did they find out about that?
Leaks.
One thing I like about you, Majid, you come with receipts.
Receipts. Right? Yeah. So when I say, now I'm going to say the statement again, and it's going to sound less crazy.
Now,
military-grade psychological operations.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I see that. That is military-grade. Now, let me ask you this. How do you think that is achieved? Do you think that's achieved through the use of things like the IRA, like how Russia uses it, troll farms, things along those lines that manipulate narratives through paid posers, like people that are pretending to be posters, but they're really just someone who works for a government organization, and they push a very specific, like, I get very suspicious when I see people with like American flags in their Twitter handle, and they talk a lot of crazy. I'm like, that might be a Fed.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of that online. I find a lot of that on Instagram where I'll see someone's page. Like, someone will send me a video. Hey, check out this video. And I go to their page. I go, this feels suspiciously not like a person. Like, this feels suspiciously like someone is trying to, like, get something to rile people up out there. Their whole page has no, there's no character to it. There's no personality. There's no emotional engagement. It's like a constant barrage of memes and videos that are inflammatory and data. And I look at it, I go, is this guy in Macedonia somewhere, you know, in a troll farm? Because we know that that's a real thing. So it's not just, like, here's the thing that we're willing to accept very easily. Yeah. We're willing to accept that foreign countries are manipulating us, right? We're willing to accept that Russia does that.
Yeah.
But the IRA...
We've just seen that we're doing it.
But that's the thing. Like, how much are we doing it, and how much do we know about... Like, the Rene DeResta's work with the IRA, when she uncovered these hundreds of thousands, Sam did a podcast with her, and then I did a podcast with her afterwards, and just talking to her about the depth of the work that they do to try to get people riled up online. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're just entering into these Christian chat groups. There was an article recently that came out that showed that out of 20 of the top Christian groups on Facebook, 19 of them were run by troll farms. 19 of them. We showed all these different, like, your baby daddy ain't that was run by troll farms. All these like really wild, inflammatory meme pages run by troll farms. And their purpose is just to rile people up. We're accepting those, like, wow, we're being attacked. Yeah. But what are we doing? We meaning, what are the intelligence agencies within this country that have a vested interest in pushing a narrative? What are they doing in this country?
Yeah.
What are they doing on social media?
And around the world.
While we're getting blocked and banned left and right for all kinds of arbitrary things. Like Unity 2020, which was Brett Weinstein's organization that was trying to put together a very respectable member of the right and a very respectable member of the left and see if they can come up with an alternative party. They were banned from Twitter for that.
Yeah. Now, Twitter's one arena, yeah?
Yes.
One battleground. A while back in this conversation, you said something which I appreciate you saying, and it's accurate, is that having been through all of this, I was able to identify some of these early warning signs. I'm trained in ideological warfare, basically. I have been as an Islamist revolutionary, and it's why the Egyptian government put me in jail. I know all these signs, and I know how it works. I know how you deconstruct a country for the purposes of destroying it from within. Now, whether it's Twitter and our use of social media platforms, but it doesn't stop there. It includes subversion through infiltration of state bodies by your operatives who are not there to serve people, but who are there to deliver the aims of your organization.
And what are the aims of the organization?
So let me play something for you by Klaus Schwab. Yeah.
Oh.
This is in Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He is speaking in 2017.
I feel like we should have Darth Vader music playing when that guy talks.
Please do it when I play.
Can you get Darth Vader music?
To this.
Hold on.
Hold it, please. We're going to have the proper music for this amazing introduction of Xi Jinping.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Tell me when.
Give me some. Just the music.
Okay, but you want to hear the audio as well.
Yes.
And I have to say, when I mention our names like Mrs. Merkel, Vladimir Putin and so on, they all have been young global leaders of the World Economic Forum. Mm-hmm. But what we are very proud of now is the young generation like Prime Minister Trudeau, President of Argentina and so on, that we penetrate the cabinets. So yesterday I was at a reception for Prime Minister Trudeau, and I know that half of this cabinet, or even more half of this cabinet, are actually young global leaders of the World Economic Forum.
And that's true in Argentina too. Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's true in Argentina as well.
It's true in Argentina, and it's true in France now. I mean, with the president, with a young global leader, but what is important for me...
So what you got there is Emperor Palpatine speaking about how in the first three Star Wars, how he's going to use democracy to put his people in place, right? He explicitly said in that quote you just heard, what we are very proud of is that we penetrate the global cabinets of countries with our World Economic Forum young global leaders, and then gave examples like Trudeau, like Macron. And it's not just him saying this. This is Tony Blair saying exactly the same thing. Our teams are now embedded in governments around the world, helping them to keep their people safe during this pandemic.
How to keep people as safe as possible, protect them as much as possible, but not simply in respect of COVID-19 itself, but in respect also of the collateral damage done by the disease. So we've been really focusing on three areas. The first is around exit strategies, particularly in the UK and other developed countries where we've published papers showing how we might exit and ease the lockdown. Secondly, of course, because of all the work we do in Africa with many different governments there, our teams have stayed in place. They're on the ground. They're working with the President and Prime Minister's teams in combating the crisis. And there, what we're focused on is trying to give them realistic ways of containing COVID-19 without doing enormous damage to economies that depend often on informal working and where the food supply chains are a critical part of keeping people alive. And then thirdly, we're working on the global coordination picture, because one of the things that has been shocking, as I said right from the very beginning, is the absence of global coordination. I think out of this...
So that one doesn't bother me.
You'll see it. Our teams are now embedded in governments around the world. That's actually what they wrote.
Yes.
And the video is 2 minutes. I didn't play all of it. It's what he says.
But what he's saying there sounds reasonable. Yeah. Figuring out on strategic ways to end the lockdown easily. Would that make sense?
Not the end of lockdown. No.
Didn't he say that?
Yeah. Keep in mind, Tony Blair is the one who's been advocating for vaccine passports, digital identification through COVID, and all of these measures.
But didn't they say that about ending the lockdowns and keeping businesses?
Once those measures are in place. right? So he's, even in the UK, his stance has been, yeah, we're going to get out of all it, but you have to have digital ID and you have to have.
So during the war, this is going to introduce the social credit score system.
Right. So all of that came from your question, which is, regardless of intention, how do people do that infiltration from within? It's not just Twitter. So back to the psychological operations. It's also embedding people in government who are subscribed to this agenda. Yeah. And the agenda of Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum is the same as the agenda of Tony Blair in this regard. They call it, on their own website, they call it the Great Reset. That's what they say themselves.
Yeah, that's a bizarre thing to do, to openly. Why do you think they openly discuss it that way? And openly, because the Great Reset has always been this gigantic conspiracy theory among the online folks. Yeah. Like, this is all part of the Great Reset. Well, when he wrote a book called The Great Reset, you're like, hey, man, shouldn't you be hiding this?
And in 2017 at Harvard, he's saying, you know, we're going to basically, all of these world leaders will penetrate their cabinets with our young global leaders. He's open. He's open. Blair's open. During the Iraq War, Blair tried to bring in ID cards in Britain. He failed. Now he's back and he's trying to bring in digital ID during COVID. Right. So they're open about it.
So this is going to be this never ending process to slowly move the goalposts
towards more and more authoritarianism. Checkpoint society. It's all there. They told us this.
People have to realize this, right? This is important.
Yeah.
When you were on your radio show, what kind of pushback did you? Can you talk about that? No.
So
can't.
I can, when it comes to those who disagreed with me in public, just not the management legal side, contract side. But there were other broadcasters that basically, some called me deranged, is one direct quote. Another, because obviously this is a whole radio group, so there's other presenters, not just my show, yeah? When I said publicly on my feed, I will not get a booster. And I said, I'm a conscientious objector to getting a booster because of mandates. And I refuse to participate in a system that removes choice. I was called deranged for saying I didn't want to get a booster. Soon afterwards, again, it all came out. And they realized that the boosters weren't doing much when it comes to the spread and transmission of COVID. So they publicly came out and attacked me for some of the things I've said here. In fact, I've gone... There's nothing I've said here I haven't already said, by the way. So I've been called an extremist for saying this, for having this discussion that I'm having with you. I've been re-radicalized. Somehow, apparently, this means that I haven't really left the group that I used to belong to.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And on top of that, I need mental help. I've got mental health problems. I'm being gaslit in that way, that I'm the one who's lost sense of reality. So when you move the goalposts in that way to such an extent that the psychological operation's purpose is to gaslight the public, as happened under communism, the person who speaks up is the person that needs psychological help, as opposed to...
Of course.
Yeah.
That's gaslighting by definition.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where we are. But as you've seen, nothing I said comes without receipts.
No. And, you know, when we were easing into this conversation, I had a feeling it was going to go this way. Yeah. But I was like, I was hoping I was going to find some holes.
Yeah.
I was hoping, like, well, maybe he's exaggerating or maybe he's... I don't see these holes.
So... Again, remember this, right? For me, it's not about intention. You can have the best of intentions and do evil. That is what Hannah Arendt meant.
I think that's a very good point. That's a very good point, because that erases the stigma that it's attached to these conspiracy theories, that there's this grand cabal of evil people that are trying to control the world.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is a sense or that they have an incentive to try to impart more control, because we're under direct competition with China and they have essentially total control over the way the Chinese government has control of their corporations, and the corporations act for the interest of the Chinese party. They act within the best interest. They're not independent, like, you know, say Harley Davidson or something like that. It does whatever they want when they would make motorcycles. Whatever you're doing in China, especially if you're involved in a technology company, you work with the government.
I'll go one step further.
Oh, okay, please.
There's something called elite capture, which is a term that I use. I believe our elite have come under the undue influence of Chinese intelligence agencies, unfortunately.
Our elite, like, who's our elite?
Our political elite.
Our political elite. Yeah, House. So, well, okay.
So if you look up BBC, Chinese spy, Parliament, MI5 have just last month... In fact, this month, I think it was, warned about this. I've been saying it since my hunger strike, which we haven't spoken about, but I went on hunger strike at the beginning of the pandemic because of the Uyghur genocide in China. I did a 5-day hunger strike to try and draw attention to the plight of the Uyghur Muslim community who are facing genocide in China, because nobody was speaking about it in the media at the time. It wasn't getting the attention it deserved. And I was a mainstream broadcaster who didn't even turn up to work because I was on hunger strike sitting outside the Chinese embassy in protest. The purpose was to get 100,000 signatures on a petition on a UK Parliament website that would force a debate in the UK Parliament on the genocide in China. We got the 100,000 signatures within 4 days, and there was a debate, and the UK Parliament unanimously voted in a symbolic vote that there was a genocide in China. And then other countries started cascading after that. Canada did the same, the Netherlands did the same. Blinken here, when he was sworn in, after my hunger strike, was asked in his swearing-in ceremony, he said, yes, I believe there's a genocide in China. And then America followed suit as well. Back in those days, when I did that hunger strike, it wasn't common, apart from Trump, it wasn't common for somebody from my background to speak about China. It was seen as a Trumpian thing to do.
Right.
And people often forget how that was in those days. And I mentioned back then that the reason I think this genocide was being not getting the attention it deserved in the press was because our elite had come under the undue influence of Chinese state CCP, right? Communist Party, not the Chinese people, but the state's influence operations in the West. And they had somehow captured our elite to head in a direction that serves the interests of China. Now, what's come out since then, it's now 2 years later. Again, like with everything else I've spoken about, it's now in the press. So there's an article in the BBC, MI5 warning over Chinese agent in Parliament. That's from the 13th of January this month. Now, that, this lady here, she's been operating with senior parliamentarians as an active spy of the Chinese Communist Party, to the point where our security services, the internal branch, MI5, had issued a rare warning, as it says at the top, right? And she's not the only one.
You want to read it for people that are just listening?
MI5 has issued a rare warning that an alleged Chinese agent has infiltrated Parliament to interfere in UK politics. An alert from the security service said Christine Ching Kui Li, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, established links for the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, with current and aspiring MPs. She then gave donations to politicians with funding coming from foreign nationals in China and Hong Kong. Specifically, we go down to the next few paragraphs there. One of the MPs funded by Ms. Li was Labour's Barry Gardner, right? So this is our opposition party, who received over £420,000. That's $500,000, yeah, from her in 5 years. But he said he's always made the security services aware of the donations. Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey also received a £5,000 donation, so a lot less. Those two parties, by the way, were very much in favour of all of the COVID mandates. And we know that the idea of lockdowns began in China. We know that the virus leaked from Wuhan. We know that China has an interest in making sure that the world follows its ideology, a bit like in the Cold War where the Soviet Union wanted us to be communists.
But can you really buy the influence of these politicians for $100,000 a year to the point where they're willing to instigate these sort of COVID lockdowns?
What you do is they don't think they're being bought. They think they're receiving money from a donor and they're serving their donor's interests like a lobby. That's how the lobby works. It's why...
They have discussions with them
and it's
about
like,
an agenda.
Yeah, and it's like, you know... So when I first started speaking about the Uyghur genocide, it was seen as racist against the Chinese to speak about the communist influence of China in the West, right? So you don't need to say, you don't need to say to somebody, here's some money, do the bidding of the CCP. You need to say, I'm funding you as a British Chinese citizen when actually they're working for the CCP. I'm worried about increasing anti-Chinese racism. Again, a legitimate concern to have. I'm going to provide money to your party and let's start trying to divert conversation away from criticizing Chinese actions because it will lead to anti-Chinese racism. And let's instead speak about the need for Huawei, the contract with Huawei, the 5G networks. So it's why we had this problem where it was so difficult to cancel those Huawei contracts, but we ended up canceling them in the end after we agreed to have them, because all of this got exposed after that hunger strike. I'm not saying I'm the reason it got exposed. I'm saying it was in chronological order, just to reassure people that what I say isn't just something that I've just plucked out of my head. It's actually then it gets reported in the press. It's happening. So the concern around China's influence in terms of not only our tech, Huawei and others, and the ability to enter our information through the back door, through the Huawei 5G networks, which have since been cancelled since Trump. And in the UK, we followed America and cancelled those pending contracts. It doesn't just apply to tech. It doesn't just apply to pro-lockdown messaging in Parliament. But you look to, we've got a nuclear reactor in the UK called Hinkley Point C. It's being built with Chinese funding. Now, I'm asking, you've got a country that's engaged in a genocide against a community for their beliefs. It doesn't tolerate diversity. And you're letting that nation controlled by the CCP work on our sensitive nuclear programs. Now, I wouldn't do that with the Soviet Union. And what I don't understand, moving this conversation slightly to foreign policy, is why are we not realizing that we've got this kind of consensus developing with the Biden administration that Putin and Russia are a threat, when actually you've got a bigger problem here with the CCP, far more powerful than Russia, far more organized, have far more centralized control, and are far wealthier, and their military is far stronger. And we've got a real elephant in the room, and that is the increasing power of the CCP-ruled China. And the influence isn't just military, but it's also soft power. So when the lockdowns first began, I signed a joint letter with other signatories, and one of the signatories was General Spalding, here at US General, and it's on the web, it's online still, and we directly alleged that Chinese influence operations have been responsible for a lot of this idea that lockdowns were our solution. It was the first nation that implemented lockdowns, and then Italy and Europe followed after China, and then the rest of Europe followed after that. And Michael Senger, who's one of the signatories to that letter, has written an extensive book on this, tracing step by step, the way I've gone through receipts with you here, he's gone through step by step these influence operations where the CCP have been encouraging a draconian response to COVID and all of this technocracy that is eventually going to arise in the form of Checkpoint Charlie Society and central banking digital currencies.
They've been encouraging other nations to implement these.
Their model.
And how do they get away with that? Like, how do these other nations comply? They comply because of influence?
Influence operations, funding, intelligence operations, as
and
you see.
And because of that, they're willing to impart laws that they would not normally do?
Who?
The governments that they're being influenced. The governments like, whether it's Great Britain, whether it's the United States, these governments are being influenced, in your mind.
With the help of the agenda coming from other non-state actors, such as the World Economic Forum, and their teams penetrating cabinets across the world, as Klaus Schwab said, that there are some supranational interests here that exist above the nation state, working, as I said to you, it's a power grab, working to define the future in a certain direction. And that is to make sure that decentralization doesn't happen. The mother of centralization is the CCP. So we're at a crossroads historically. We can either move towards decentralization and people power, which means local governments, decentralized power, community, family, and a separation of powers, or we move in the CCP direction. And there's a term for this in political science. It's called the Thucydides trap. How does a rising power overtake an existing power? Rising power, China, existing power, America. How does a rising power overtake an existing power without war? The term Thucydides trap is a term to describe that historically, whenever we've been in this moment, war has happened because nobody sits by quietly and allows for that rising power to take them over. So we're in that moment now, and our challenge is how do we navigate this Thucydides trap moment with the rise of China without us going to war with China, but also stave off their influence. But that's the moment I believe we are in history. And I'll just say, I don't know how long we have, by the way, and I'm talking a lot.
We basically just hit the 3-hour mark.
Cool. I mean, I don't know how long you're comfortable with talking, but I'm happy to stop whenever you want me to. The situation now in Ukraine, I believe it's a folly. Russia and Putin, of course, like, you know, all governments, they have their own interests, their own agendas, yeah? But what we really should be looking at isn't throwing Russia further into the bosom of China, which is what we're doing at the moment. You've got a Russia-China alliance against us. Surely, if we're going to be clever, we need to be able to use diplomacy with Putin and separate Russia from China. Because the bigger danger is China, not Russia. Russia isn't our friend, but the bigger danger is China. The way we're behaving at the moment, whether it's with Ukraine or in Syria, is we're pushing that alliance closer. You've got Iran, Russia, China, and they've got cooperation. With Biden's screw up in Afghanistan, and not the fact we withdrew, I've never been for the war, as we've discussed, but the way he withdrew, the Taliban now have more Black Hawk helicopters than the entire British Army because of Biden, right? The Bagram Air Base, that was the American base in Afghanistan, the Daily Mail reported, and you can look it up if you want to, but I'll just tell you, the Daily Mail reported that Chinese military have now landed at Bagram. So you've got this axis developing, Russia, China, Iran, and Afghanistan, ruled by the Taliban. If we're going to be clever, we've got to realize this rising bloc, it's not in our interests for them to stay united in that way. We should be attempting diplomacy with Russia and focusing on China as a rising concern. Because unlike Russia, not only does China have a stronger economy and a stronger military, those things I can handle. The problem I've got is China is stronger ideologically. It has a alternative consensus about that crossroads we're at. China has a centralized system and it has soft power to advocate for that centralized system. It believes in itself and its technocracy and its social credit system. In other words, it's like the Soviet Union. It has the ability to sell itself because it's cohesive. Russia doesn't have that centralized social credit system. It doesn't have that, you know, thing that the Chinese have with that kind of strong centralized power with an ideology behind it. Russia is a traditional country, not an ideological country, at least since the collapse of the Soviet Union. What we should be worried about is the ideological country, because ideologies peddle soft power and they influence minds with their agenda and they influence narratives. And what we've missed, because we aren't in the West attuned to ideological warfare, we've missed that bit. we've missed the fact that the CCP has been influencing through its narratives, it's been influencing the world in this hybrid war way with its disinformation campaigns. A lot of these fake accounts on Twitter, by the way, Twitter themselves have confessed that a lot of them were run by the CCP. And so this disinformation is being peddled from that side. If we could divide Russia from China, we stand a stronger chance in that Thucydides trap moment of the rise of China, how to navigate around that.
I feel like you and I can have another 15 of these three-hour conversations. Mm. So we got to do this again.
Can I quickly tell you what I'm doing
next? Yes, please.
Yeah. So having, how do I put this diplomatically? Having had my services no longer required.
Perfect.
For my mainstream
media. You should have a podcast. And I know I've said that to a billion people. And I'm going to say it to you because I think you more than anybody are qualified for this.
Well, I will. I'll be on. So that's what I wanted to tell you.
Okay.
So there's three things I'm going to do. Having my services no longer being required on that talk show. So I'm working with Odyssey, which is a online video platform like YouTube.
Yes.
But it's decentralized. So the videos sit on a blockchain. So that YouTube yesterday took down Dan Bongino's show.
Yeah. And they took it down?
Took it down. Suspended. And they took down Trigonometry.
Well, okay. When they take these down, they're taking them down for a specific period of time or forever?
I don't know. But that's why I decided.
I know the Trigonometry thing. I heard Jordan Peterson told me about that last night. Yeah. I was shocked.
So I thought, I'm not going to go down that route in the first place. There we are,
permanently bans Dan Bongino. What did he say?
I mean, it came out of nowhere. Right, so I don't imagine he said anything. Let's have a look. YouTube on Wednesday permanently banned conservative commentator Dan Bongino from the platform, saying he attempted to evade a previous suspension. I mean, you know how this works. I mean,
so he violated the rules by trying to evade a previous suspension, I think it says.
Yeah.
The Fox host uploaded a video to his main channel while his secondary channel, which primarily hosted short clips from his digital radio show, was actively suspended for violating YouTube's COVID-19 misinformation policy. When a channel receives a strike, it is against our terms of services to post content or use another channel to circumvent the suspension. Okay, well that...
Meanwhile, newspapers can say anti-vaxxer dies while he's vaccinated, and there's no repercussions for that.
Right.
Right. Anyway, yeah. So the point is, whether it's him, whether it's Trigonometry, they've been taken down. So I didn't want to go down that route.
Yeah.
So I've been speaking to Odyssey. As Julian is their CEO, and he's been very kind. And I'm going to put my show on this other platform called Odyssey, which is decentralized.
Isn't Brett's show on that as well?
I think so.
Yeah.
And it's called Radical with Majid Nawaz.
There's Rumble, which is another platform that's more open.
So I spoke to those guys too, but I think with me, with Odyssey, see, it's built on the blockchain tech.
Yes.
And Rumble, I don't think its videos are decentralized in that way. So
that's
even if the Odyssey website's removed, the library blockchain check that those videos sit on stay on the blockchain, and I will then own my own content. So that's my idea. I think I want to live by example. If I'm worried about going either in a centralized direction with the planet or a decentralized direction, I want to try and move my own media content in the decentralized way.
Walk the walk.
And the other thing I've got is that Substack, which I set up as soon as I lost my gig. And I do sort of written content on there. And finally, I'll be doing some collaboration with Getter as an alternative to Twitter, just to try and have that diversity on the Twitter space. So I'll be doing some videos and live streaming and tweet content on Getter as well. But that's those three, Odyssey, Substack, and Getter, will be where people will be able to find me. The content's called Radical, whether it's on Odyssey, it's Radical with Majid Nawaz. On Substack, it's called The Radical Dispatch. And my name on Getter, you can find me on there as well.
Majid, I appreciate you. This was everything I wanted and more. I'm so glad we did it. And we'll do it again. My pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You've been listening to a very special two-hour presentation of Majid Nawaz talking to Joe Rogan, recorded on February 17th. My show runs every other Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. I'll see you again in 2 weeks with more information.